Criminal Law Revision Commission, Saturday, February 22nd, 1969, Room 315, State Capitol Building. On today's agenda, forgery and related offenses, preliminary draft number 2, arson and related offenses, preliminary draft number 4, kidnapping and related offenses, preliminary draft number 3.
See that we have such a good turnout. Judge Burns has some, before we get underway, has some guests here that I think he would like to present to the committee.
Chairman, thank you. There's recently been formed an organization known as Criminal Justice Research Associates, which high sounding title covers a multitude of disciplines and perhaps sins, but it includes, among others, correction people, parole and probation officers. It includes a number of the faculty from Oregon College of Education in London, and a few judges crept in somewhere. We've had a couple of meetings, and I invited Mr. Walter Evans, who's down in the seat of close to Justice Sloan, to be here this morning. He is on the board of that organization. He is the chief U.S. probation officer here in the state of Oregon. Also, Mr. Jack Wiseman, I expect many of you know him, who's head of the Department of Parole and Probation in Oregon, and Mr. Lee, who is an assistant to Mr. Evans in the U.S. Probation Office. And I might just mention, Mr. Chairman, that one of the things that has been talked about in this new group is that they could very well provide valuable research and other resources, particularly in the field of sentencing. We haven't got to yet, but that will take a lot of work and study, and I expressed the opinion to Mr. Evans and the others that this would be indeed welcome, I'm sure, by this commission, and I've communicated this with Don Tillett and made the connection in that fashion.
Thank you very much, and we're delighted that you're here, gentlemen. We'll be looking forward to a great deal of assistance from you sometime in the near future. I don't suppose anybody wishes the minutes of the November 21, 22, and January 18 meetings read, because I know you've all read them. If there's no objection, we'll...
I move their adoption.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. The minutes of those dates be approved. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion's carried.
Do you want to tell them about our little meeting at Grashfield?
I'm going to let you do that. Senator, and incidentally, I have a letter. Why don't you start, and I'll give this letter.
Well, just for those people who aren't on my subcommittee, bring you up to date. As you know, there are some federal funds available through the Safe Streets Act of 1968, I think. And about 2 weeks ago, the chairman and I met with Ed Branchfield and the director of the Crime Control Coordinating Council, and also two people from the Law Enforcement Assistance Office in Washington. And they're setting up a regional law enforcement assistance office in San Francisco at the end of the year. And a certain amount of money has been allocated to the state, which will be channeled through the Crime Control Coordinating Council, and we are in the process of putting in an application for some of these funds. We were advised, however, that we might not get in under the wire in time because we're supposed to be a action group, and the money that's available this year is planning money. But the longer we talked with them, the more we convinced them that there was some merit in our program, and that time was of the essence because our life expires in 1971. And so they told us that there's a contingency fund in the law Office of Law Enforcement Assistance that has several hundred thousand dollars in it that can be released for worthy projects in the discretion of the director. And so we're in the process of making an application for those funds, and it's possible that we'll get some more money from that source to get more drafting help, so that we can get back on schedule. But in any event, I thought that it would be appropriate to bring you up to date on that.
This Roderick Gardner, who's the director of law enforcement planning, in a letter that I just received, tells me that in this fiscal year, that Oregon will be eligible for $202,000 of action grants between now and June 30th. And that in the following year, they expect at least a $300 million appropriation from Congress. But I asked him to, they're a little coy about this thing for some reason. It's hard to dig out any information, but I asked him point blank to give me, as far as he could identify them, the various agencies in Oregon who might be eligible or who would be applying for these funds. And here are two typewritten single space sheets. State agencies, state police, border police, standards and training, corrections division, border parole, judicial council, crime control, coordinating committee, adjutant general, board of aeronautics, Oregon state bar, governor's committee, and et cetera, and et cetera. And then in the cities and counties, for the different programs, there's about 20 more. So I don't know where we'll end up, but I think that we'll probably have some assistance from that source. This should be those, your records.
Maybe we can get Rod Gardner's budget down in Ways and Means, Tony.
Well, I think you should hold it a little bit. Consider it thoroughly. The first item is forgery that was committed by that was studied by subcommittee number one. John, do you want to?
Well, I think probably, Mr. Chairman, I'll let Don carry it. Preliminary draft of number one of forgery was considered at the subcommittee meeting on November 15th. That's in K of the blue books. I don't know, are the minutes in the, sometimes it's helpful to know where the minutes are.
We have the subcommittee minutes here. They're not in the black books, but the subcommittee minutes are here. We brought some of the subcommittee number one books over if we want to read through any of those minutes.
Yeah, it's in your right. Black book, the first.
All right. And it's
subject.
The first subject in the black book. And I think probably, Don, if you'd just follow along like we did the last edition, I mean, I think it's better to do it that way.
All right. Mr. Chairman, forgery and related offenses is one of the larger single articles that subcommittee number one worked on. And this is one of the, in fact, it's the last major article in the section on crimes against property. Although it's really an area of fraud for the purposes of classification, schematically in our drafting process, we have placed it in the category of crimes against property. The forgery draft generally follows, with some modifications that are pointed out as we go through, generally follows the New York Revised Penal Law. And now, Mr. Chairman, in the past, we have proceeded section by section to inquire if there's any questions on.
Yes, I think that's the way we should proceed.
And I'll attempt to answer any questions any of you have at this time with respect to section one. Now, these are our definitions that would apply throughout the entire article, not only with respect to forgery, but with respect to some of the related offenses. These definitions attempt to set out comprehensively the terms that are used throughout the draft. The approach is to, as you can see from looking at the draft, to define first a written instrument, and then to take it on through and to distinguish between a complete written instrument and incomplete written instrument. And then with respect to the types of acts that would be prohibited under the draft, we have the definitions under sub 4, 5,
Don, pardon me for
six.
For interrupting one moment. It might be helpful to the new members In case you want to look at the New York revised penal law or the model penal code, just over in those green or blue sheets, you'll find those so that you can get back and forth on them. Pardon me, Don.
Yes. Now, we have a definition of to falsely make, and sub 4 and sub 5, to falsely complete and to falsely alter. Now, sub 7, we have a definition of utter. This is a new definition and is not taken from the New York law, but we felt that it was helpful to have a definition of utter in the draft. Then the Section 2 then starts into the basic degree of forgery. So with respect to the commentary, the way in which these definitions are applied are explained further following each of the respective sections on forgery. Now, as pointed out in the commentary on page 2, a written instrument includes every kind of a writing or other article that may be the subject of forgery. And I think I should point out to you that a written instrument does not necessarily mean only a paper document. It is intended to include any type of article or document or paper that contains written or printed matter or its equivalent, which and also further defining it that's used for the purpose of reciting, embodying, conveying, or recording information, or constituting a symbol or evidence of value, right, privilege, or identification. Now, this would include such things as credit cards, for example, and also coins, stamps, and then as we go through respective sections, the grade of forgery is dependent upon the type of written instrument that is either falsely made or falsely completed or falsely altered.
May I ask a question, please?
Yes.
In your definition of utter, I think I understood you say that this was one that the subcommittee itself, or that you prepared.
Yes.
Do the other codes, New York or model, have definitions of uttering?
No, they don't include a definition. The idea was to attempt to formulate a definition for a term that's been used over a long period of time and has come to have certain fixed meanings, and in an attempt to make this as comprehensive as possible, set it out, but New York does not define this. Now, there may be some other codes that do define it. I'm not aware of any that have attempted to define this term.
Well, the reason I asked, I wondered whether we actually accomplish anything by using the words such as circulate and disseminate. I think it's probably a good idea to keep it as broad as possible, but if you issue, deliver, publish, transfer, or tender, I'm not at all sure that circulate or disseminate or have any particular different meaning.
Perhaps there's
a type of transaction, however, that wouldn't apply to. I don't suppose there's any real harm in getting it extremely broad.
The real essence of the crime of uttering is the tendering. And in preliminary draft number 1, we did not have uttering, but of course 165, 115 our present KUFPC statute provides something that our first draft didn't have, and so we included the definition of uttering and put it into the degrees.
What
but
comment
I agree,
was there in the subcommittee with respect to circulate and disseminate?
There was none, Mr. Chairman, and I think Judge Burns probably has a valid point. I can't foresee a instance where that would be appropriate.
Well, if there's a type of transaction that wouldn't be, that ought to be made the subject of a crime and wouldn't be caught up with the other words, we ought to leave them in, I think. But I don't suppose it does any real harm, Mr. Chairman, to leave them in. I'm not really objecting to it. It's kind of required.
Don, why don't we go to the to section 2 and start in on forgery in the second degree on page 4. And then maybe after we do that, the definitions will possibly fall into place. And if there are questions about that, we can go back to section 1.
Right. It's a little difficult to discuss the definitions without trying to apply them to a specific crime here, but... Now, in section 2 on page 4 of your draft, forgery in the second degree defines the basic forgery offense. A person commits the crime of forgery in the second degree if with intent to injure or defraud, he, one, falsely makes, completes, or alters a written instrument, or two, utters a written instrument which he knows to be forged. Now, the... draft provides for two ascending degrees of forgery. This follows a pattern in drafts of other crimes that we've worked on. Start with the basic definition and then enhance that, in this case, by the type of document or written instrument that's forged. Now, this section comes from New York, section 170.05, and as I pointed out, definition section, we have the definition of uttering, and we incorporate in our draft the crime of uttering into our basic definition, whereas the New York Code places uttering in with possession of a forged instrument, but interestingly enough, the penalty provisions are the same under the New York draft for either one. So it's, there really isn't any substantial difference. It's just a question that we felt that, particularly in connection with our existing law, that this was a good step to take to place uttering in with the basic crime of forgery rather than with possession.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Lent.
Don, there in your section 2, you have with intent to injure or defraud. Now, intent to defraud, according to your commentary, is what's needed in the common law. Why are we adding injure now here?
Well, that's retained from our existing statute. That's exact language out of ORS right now.
Is it possible we could be getting into something along the lines, if you look at this not in the context that we're thinking of it in forgery, that you're getting into something like libel perhaps here? Suppose I falsely make, complete, or alter a written instrument with the mere purpose just of blacking someone's name. That's the injury I intend.
With no motive, no extortion motive or anything like that.
Well, of course.
Well, New York says with intent to defraud, deceive or injure another.
That language has, to my knowledge, that language of injuring has never caused any particular problem in the cases, in the Oregon cases up to now. Of course, you're talking usually in terms of a property fraud situation with respect to forgery, but it isn't necessary, of course. It is not an element of the crime to obtain any property or anything.
Of course, he says he falsely make a written instrument. Does that mean, issuing a press release of someone?
Supposing I change something that's in a will or some other instrument, only for the purpose just of making it appear as if the maker of that instrument had said something about Doug Graham that wasn't true. no intent at all to get any
property.
Property or anything else, just merely to injure him by injuring his good name.
I think it'd be forgery.
I think so too.
Maybe.
I think it'd be forgery in the first degree if the will were involved.
Well, all I'm saying is if you want to keep this in this idea in here, then certainly you need the words.
I'm not so sure that it would, because what you're saying is you draw a will and in addition to all the other dispositive provisions, you throw in a clause saying Doug Graham is a reprehensible so-and-so. And that wouldn't be falsely making a written instrument.
When I say I altered it.
Well,
I had a paragraph in that wasn't in there when the maker made you the will.
Now, sub 6 in your definition defines falsely altered.
That wouldn't apply with sub 6, though, because...
Insertion of new matter is covered under falsely altering.
Yes, and that's what your sub 1 is here. Falsely makes completes or alters a written instrument to do what? To injure another, not to defraud him.
Supposing you add a paragraph in this will that says that the reason the testator didn't leave anything to Doug Graham is because he'd had an illicit affair with Miranda Smith. He's changed that. There's no property loss or anything. He wasn't included in it. And initially, I'd say it would be forgery under this.
I'd say it would be forgery under this. That's what I mean.
Yes.
And then my question is, do we intend it?
It would be forgery under 165.105 too.
Today. See, wills are covered under existing law.
And it would be a forgery under the Model Penal Code.
I'm not worried about the fact that it's a will.
Yeah.
It could be anything.
Yeah.
I just used a will as an example.
Yeah.
I'm talking about doing this. What we're talking about here is if we intend to cover this, then fine, that sort of thing. But I think the language we have here is broad enough to cover it.
George?
I think we ought to remember, I think you have a good point. We ought to remember basically what forgery is. It's a theft crime.
No, it isn't, George.
Yes, it is.
It's a
forgery has traditionally been treated as a separate crime, but the Model Penal Code comments, if you remember reading them, said that it thought very seriously of eliminating the crime of forgery entirely and incorporating it within the crime of theft. The point I'm making is, I think agreeing with the gentleman here, that the kind of alteration of the will that he hypothecates ought not to be forgery. It ought not to be a crime. It is not theft. No one benefits from the thing in the criminal way. And if there's any possibility that this kind of a changing of a will might result in criminal prosecution, then I think that we ought to perhaps narrow the definition. The remedy perhaps would be civil. I don't know what it would be, some kind of a tort action. I think we should be very careful that we don't expand this particular crime, which I really think is not needed anyhow.
Well, if the essence of forgery is theft, then following that out to its logical conclusion, this would all be covered by our draft on theft by deception.
That's precisely correct.
And it'd be unnecessary. But I don't think that the essence of forgery is theft.
Well,
I think that it's a fraudulent.
There's certainly a good basis for having a separate crime, merely on tradition, if nothing else.
Well, that's what the Model Penal Code.
Yeah.
Well, what would you must remember that this is in the second degree. Here.
It's true in the first
degree. Is this also in the, yes, it is also in the first degree. But what would the offense be under our statutes?
Yes, there is a criminal liable. But I think, Mr. Chairman, that the manner in which injure or defraud has been traditionally used doesn't necessarily make them mutually exclusive. And I would hate to have it go into the record that the hypothetical that you posed, well, as a part of the legislative history that some court might look at later and say, well, by golly, when those fellas put that in there, that's what they meant. I'd hate to have them make a decision based upon the assumption that we are saying that that would be forgery. I'm not sure that it would.
Well,
it isn't intended to be forgery.
If Well, Glenn, why don't you say something about Doug Graham didn't court you?
Well, one of the sections that this forgery is to replace is 165.145 on the transmission delivery of the false and forged messages.
Yeah.
And this, sending any message by telegraph or pretty much otherwise with the intent to deceive, injure, or defraud any individual partnership or corporation. So, like almost everywhere where these words, where the term defraud is used, it's injure or defraud. And here they even had to deceive a person. This is one of the statutes that we're trying to cover all in one statute.
Well, yeah, and I'm not so sure that. In fact, I'm quite sure we're not changing existing Oregon law that much, George, with respect, for example, to the hypothetical on the will again.
I see that.
I mean, we're not expanding the law here.
That doesn't necessarily, we don't know what the word injure means in the cases, do we? Because it's now existing law doesn't mean that there might not be a problem with existing law, too, in this situation.
Well, but your statement was that you didn't think we should expand the crime, and I'm saying that I don't think we're expanding the crime as it exists now.
Certainly, I don't think you intend to.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the Oregon cases that go back, and which Don has researched and are enumerated at the bottom of page 4, seem to hold that the requisite element here, or the requisite intent, is the intent to defraud. And that being the case, and I'm assuming that you didn't find any other cases which held that there was an intent to injure was something different, it would seem to me that maybe this has grown up with the use of injure as synonymous with defraud.
Supposing that we left it out and the matter comes up in the future, they'll inquire as to why this commission left it out and said that we are changing in some manner the nature of that crime, unless the commentary showed quite clearly that we did not intend to do it. And while there haven't been any cases in Oregon yet that have interpreted what injure means, nevertheless, I don't think that we should delete it simply because we're assuming that it's synonymous with defraud. We've had it for so long, we don't want the courts to think, well, now they've changed the nature of this crime and this is something different. And a situation will come up in which perhaps defraud isn't present, injure is. The court would no doubt say, well, now that is not intended to be covered any longer, or as it was before.
We felt in the subcommittee that this language, which is existing statutory language, should be retained with respect to the intent element of the crime.
The Michigan statute, code rather, does not use the word injure, it simply uses intent to defraud, but it defines that to mean the purpose to use deception or to injure someone's interest which has value. Presumably, even though they left the word injure out, if it was in the earlier Michigan code, still the thought of injury in the comprehended within the term defraud.
Still includes it.
I guess you just can't go around with Miranda Smith.
Throw an additional fillip in here. I'm wondering, did the subcommittee have a purpose in taking out the word deceive that's in the New York statute?
Yes.
You talk about defraud, you carry with it, as I recall, a lot of excess baggage from the common law on the knowledge of the maker, the statement is false, the delivery of the intent to deprive them of value. And then there's no definition of defraud either in the statute. And I don't see in the commentary here any court definition other than the old, what I assume is probably the common law definition.
Well, I think that probably was taken out because of the theft by deception.
Which is coming later?
Which we've already proved.
Which has come, huh?
Would this be fair to say, Don?
Is the Michigan, text of the Michigan code in our black book? It's not, is it?
No, we have the model penal code and the New York code set out here. We have Michigan here. We have a copy of the Michigan draft right here.
What do you think? Should we leave it in, or?
Yes.
I would think that we should leave it in, and go on to any other technical objections that we might have, and to see the difference between, or the way we structured the first and second degree, so we can look at it in context, and then if we still have a violent objection, come back to it.
No.
So why do you pick up the rest of section two, Don?
If I could, I would like to just comment briefly before we go on to section three. On section two, I noted in the commentary a couple of Oregon cases, the State versus Swank and Daugherty versus Gladden, and Hans Lindy at Oregon Law School in 1959 raised the question of whether these two cases created a problem with respect to forgery and uttering, and whether or not they might be two different crimes as a result of those cases. And the draft attempts to clarify this issue by making forgery a single crime. And in other words, it could be either committed by making, completing, or altering a written instrument, or by uttering.
Well, as I understand, take the present case of the fellow, walks up to the Fred Meyer counter and attempts to cash a check, and he's arrested in the bargain, and you can prove generally that the signature was not that of the reported maker. You can take him on uttering.
Right.
And traditionally, you can take him on uttering, and normally you don't bother about forgery because it's pretty hard to prove that he himself forged. But I take it from what you're saying here, if he did have a case where you could prove that he both forged it himself and uttered it, you wouldn't charge him with two counts.
No.
It would be a single crime.
He wanted the other.
All right. Then later on, as you'll see, Mr. Chairman, we've included a new crime of criminal possession of a forged instrument, which gets to the person that doesn't quite get to the counter with the check. Okay. Move into page 8, right?
Right. On page 8, forgery in the first degree. This takes the basic crime that is defined in section 2 and would make it a more severe crime if the written instrument that was forged happened to be any of the following that are set out here under the five subsections. Money and stocks and bonds, deed, wills, codicils, etc., or a public record, or a record that would be in the nature of a public record, one that issued by a public office. Now, with respect to Oregon law, we're not, at least we didn't intend to change the existing statutory coverage with respect to these types of documents that are now covered under 165-105. Our definitions are different with respect to subs 1 and 2, where we extend those a little bit over existing statute. Sub 3 takes in the types of documents that are set out in 165-105 now.
Section 3, do you consider checks as being a commercial instrument or other document?
Yes.
So, is there any reason to take why you left the word checks out? Didn't want to limit it to
Well, we felt that it was covered by. And then we go on to say, which or any or other document which does or may evidence, create, transfer, alter, terminate, or otherwise affect a legal right, interest, obligation, or status. We felt that was broad enough to include checks.
When the present Fourth Generic Statute does include the word checks.
Yes, it does.
We're in our commentary on the thing that we should have it, we consider checks to be here, so they would argue that, well, if you took the
I have a question. Are you ready for questions on subsection 3? I have a question on subsection 2. What is intended to be covered by the phrase or other instruments representing interest in or claims against property or enterprise?
My question is, what meaning does enterprise have?
Well, what meaning does the whole phrase have?
Yeah.
The reason I raise this question is I have the impression that stocks and bonds are pretty well recognized categories, but there are a number of other types of interests. You run into this, for example, in your securities law and blue sky law and so on, and I wonder if you intend to cover other types of shares, shall I say, property or enterprises, and if you do, do you not run some danger of the court invoking the rule of, which I can never pronounce, but it means that life.
Custom genius.
Yes, right. Custom genius. I wonder whether I'm unduly worried or not about that.
Well, how about debentures or warrants? Would they be commercial instruments? Not necessarily.
The organizational subscription.
The first part of that doesn't bother me, but the only thing that does is the word or enterprise. What particular meaning does that have?
Well, enterprise was intended to cover business enterprises, that type of thing.
Like a prospectus or something?
And specifically a commercial enterprise is what we had. Now,
I wonder why we should, perhaps we shouldn't say it if that's what we mean. Be an enterprise, has value of some sort, other than a business or commercial enterprise. Does New York, the Model Penal Code, use that?
Yes.
Model Penal Code.
This is taken from New York.
Model Penal Code language is or part of an issue of stock, bonds, or other instruments representing interest in or claims against any property or enterprise.
Is that 224.1?
Yes.
That's set out in your blue sheets, I believe, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I don't remember any discussion in the subcommittee specifically with respect to enterprise. Bruce, I recall that we had a long and lengthy discussion about public records. And those are recited in the
Well, it seems to me, Mr. Chairman, that if there are if there are types of documents along the line of stocks and bonds are intended to be covered, that this is an area where it is helpful to parties and litigants in the courts later on. If you have, let's say, an illustration to give of a type of thing to which this language could well apply.
Well, the New York law, Jim says, part of an issue of stock, bonds, or other instruments representing interests in or claims against a corporate or other organization or its property.
Well, take, for example, your condominium type situation. I don't know, as I understand, this is a fairly unique field or a new and growing field of law, and an interest in a condominium is a somewhat different breed of cat. Would that be covered? It'd be an instrument representing an interest in property, I suppose.
Well, I was trying to check the New York commentary here, and they don't comment specifically.
Neither does the Model Penal Code commentary seem to say anything particular about it.
I said New York, I meant Michigan, said the corporate group.
Does Michigan have the use of the word enterprise?
No. It says part of an issue of stocks, bonds, or other instruments representing interest in or claims against a corporate or organization or its property.
Can we take it backwards? We're dividing forgery into two degrees, and we're first saying that you're guilty of forgery in the second degree if with an intent to injure or defraud you falsely make, complete, or alter a written instrument, or utter a written instrument which you know to be forged. And so from our own experience, we know, we think of the check writer, the payroll, check burglar, et cetera, et cetera. And we have it in our mind, but that's second degree forgery. But now we come to first degree forgery, where we attempt to categorize the crime by the type of the instrument forged. And we're going to say this is a higher level of forgery if, for example, it's counterfeiting. And in subsection 1 of section 3, we're embracing the whole raft of counterfeiting statutes that we have on the books now that has grown up over the years. And then, say, at the higher degree in subsection 2, if it's commercial instruments, stocks, bonds, and we have it, well, not really commercial instruments, but stocks or bonds or debentures or things like this, and then we go on down. I do recall the example of the condominium, of one that was brought out in the subcommittee. But I'm certainly not wedded to the language of enterprise. I think probably, Don, we just picked it up because it was in the Model Penal Code.
Yes, that's Model Penal Code.
And their commentary is silent with respect to that. Am I correct?
No.
Let me ask this, Chairman. Let's assume that you're prosecuting let's just take an interest in a condominium.
Doesn't have anything to do with commercial.
If the court concluded that it didn't fall within subsection 2, I take it the forgery in the second degree would be a lesser included crime.
I'm sorry, Jim.
In other words, if a court came to the conclusion that a particular type of an instrument didn't fall within this subsection 2, it would still be a crime under
second degree forgery.
Second degree forgery as a lesser included crime.
Correct.
It wouldn't get off the hook entirely.
Right. But this raises my question, and it's a stupid question, Mr. Chairman. But Don, since we've covered forgery in the first degree so broadly, what's left for second degree forgery?
Anything that we've forgotten.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
But what, for example?
So as not to let the boy devil out of his mind.
Well, one of them would be the doctor's prescription in the New York statute, which is under third degree.
Now we've combined two sections, you see,
right,
in one.
There's quite a list of things under the third degree forgery in New York Penal Code.
Well, isn't Jim's example a good reason for having the second degree?
Although I think Judge Byrne's example could possibly come under sub 3 of section 3.
Well, yes, it very well might. I'm not sure. We don't have a definition, do we, of the phrase commercial instrument?
No, we have a definition of written instrument.
Yeah, but not commercial.
Yes, no, we don't have a definition of that, a separate definition.
Don, I think that in some way that we should relate sub 2 of section 3, though, to something of value or a business or a corporate deal, because a hunting expedition that some of us are planning next fall could be an enterprise. I think it leaves a dangling.
Wally, or Mr. Chairman, Wally Carson just showed me Webster's, and definition of enterprise is a carrying on of projects. This is the participation in undertakings. Glenn Houston wouldn't like that, undertakings.
Like the dancing club.
I think the Michigan...
How does that language read again, Michigan Code?
You see how ours reads. Here's how Michigan reads. Part of an issue of stock, bonds, or other instruments representing interests in or claims against a corporate or other organization or its property.
Other business organization or just other organization?
No, other organization or its property.
We're back to the dance club then.
Yeah.
Part interest in or claims against. Give me that again. Here.
I think that's what it means, because you're talking about stocks, bonds, and instruments. Take an instrument of a certificate of some sort of a nonprofit organization.
Well, what we wanted to do was we wanted to make five categories. One for the government securities and coins and things like that. Second, business instruments. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
Third, deeds, wills, commercial instruments. Check. Fourth, public records. And then the official public documents. And so there's no question but that the intent of the subcommittee was to limit Section 2 to business related oriented instruments.
That's right.
Mr. Chairman.
Judge Sloan.
Guys, make a suggestion. You can use either the word entity, a commercial entity, or a person. I was wondering if throughout this entire code, if there could have been any areas of present code for criminal conduct for a person. Kind of include any kind of an enterprise or a business or thing that's functioning.
We just
agree to do the same thing with entity and define it.
Well, we've already defined, or will have defined, persons, including corporations. We could say property or person. Person or property.
So, well, then why couldn't you just use the word person then?
Yeah, I think we probably could. I think that's a good suggestion.
Claims against any person.
All right. Think for a thing. Your suggestion would be to delete the enterprise or and have property or any property or person. Yeah. You think that cures it, Bruce?
Mm-hmm. I don't really see him.
And person is defined. We defined it in the last subcommittee meeting. Mr. Chairman, then I'll move that we amend Section 2 by following the words property or insert person and delete enterprise.
You've heard the motion. Is there any further discussion? Not all in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lant.
I suppose this is nitpicking in the first degree, but down in subsection 5, we were talking, of course, about a written instrument which is issued or created. Now, officially, does that apply to both to created and to issued? Because I'm getting a case, you got public service. Suppose it's public service, but he doesn't do it in his official capacity. Is officially then intended, just so we have the record straight, to modify both issued and created?
Yes, it is.
All right. We have the comment now.
It has to both be officially created and officially issued in order for this to attach.
Mm-hmm. One created or officially issued, yeah. But officially is the thing. So if the public servant doesn't have any private capacity, and then you get into this higher depth.
I'd like to ask a question on subsection 5. There. What types of things that are whomped out are covered by this section? For example, is a press release covered?
Officially issued?
Well, it's certainly officially issued by public information officers, PR men, I think they're often called, from all kinds of
things.
Like any government agency.
Okay. Back to written instrument.
Yeah, we have to go back to our definition of written instrument.
Which covers about everything under the sun.
Yeah.
Using writing.
We had a long discussion in subcommittee, not on press releases, but upon public servant type documents, I think.
Yes, we did.
Used for the purpose of presenting, embodying, or conveying, or recording information.
It could cover any situation.
It's being used to the advantage of disciplining the December. Would be.
Yeah, it would.
Well, take, for example, Multnomah County, in its wisdom, now has a newsletter, but it's a monthly publication. It's called, forget the name, but it's certainly a written matter used for the purpose of conveying information, which is capable of being used to the advantage of disobeying or some person. Would this fall within subsection 5?
I would say it would.
I do too.
I'm not so sure I'd make that forgery in the first degree. I don't mean to demean the efforts of those who produce those things, but
there might be differences of opinion.
Bud Lent says, I do not support a sales tax. Someone changes it to say, I do. And then it's circulated, and thereafter we thereafter we tell everyone that he does works to his advantage or disadvantage, as the case may be. I don't know. I don't think that's the type of thing. What you're really talking about is certificates. Like in the Michigan Code, they have 1,000 examples here. Trapping license, certificates by the Motor Vehicle Department. These were all separate statutes. Certificate of financial responsibility, warehouse receipt, cream test report, oil production report, foresters report. They do have them under first degree, though. Certificate regulating cutting and sale of Christmas trees, deer hunting licenses, trapping license, certificate of eligibility to practice healing arts, license of a master pilot engineer, private detective agency license, and many others. Prescription to obtain a narcotic drug.
Mr. Chairman, doesn't our problem come within the definition of written instrument? And the part of it that says used for the purpose of reciting, embodying, conveying, or recording information. And if we're talking about a crime against value, we'll take that out and go on to simply say constituting symbol or evidence of value, right, privilege, or identification. That takes us completely out of the press release field, the governor's message field, the...
Say that again.
Well, looking at Section 1, definitions, written instrument, if after the word incomplete on the third line, we simply took out used for the purpose of reciting, embodying, conveying, or recording information, or, so it would read, written instrument means any paper document, instrument, or article containing written or printed matters, or the equivalent thereof, whether complete or incomplete, constituting a symbol or evidence of value, right, privilege, or identification, which is capable of being used to advantage or disadvantage to some person. That covers your Christmas tree license, certificate of to practice a business. And takes us out of the PR field.
Where did you start your deletion?
Well, the word used incomplete in the third line.
All right, and then where'd you stop?
Next line, the last or. After the or. Just before
kind of. If you're going to have that first degree, that might be a good catch-all place for the second degree.
Yeah.
Michigan has a second degree.
The what written instrument?
The propaganda.
The officially created issuance of the government license.
Well,
we were trying to hold down the number of degrees as we have in the past on these, and so we have combined what is New York and Michigan separate degrees and put them into one. The public record now, of course, is included as part of the basic forgery section in ORS.
What we were trying to get at is a problem that was raised in the Brantley case where there was a forged certificate of nomination. And there's about two pages of commentary on page 7 of the minutes of October 18th concerning this.
Wouldn't that fall within right, privilege, or identification, though, John?
Wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Well, in the Brantley case, though, wasn't that so they held it wasn't a public record and therefore not subject to forgery?
Yes, it was a certificate of nomination. They said it was not a public record.
All right. So then it would fall within sub 5, a written instrument, right?
Yes.
See, we originally had subsection 4 to read, a public record or an instrument filed or required by or authorized by law to be filed with the public office or public servant. So we deleted everything except a public record or, and tried to reach the situation that was prevalent in the Brantley case by sub 5. But I think maybe Dave Frost suggested it was a good one.
Well, I don't like to take that.
All that language out
as it might apply to second degree.
Yeah. No, I
don't either. But I think we do have subsection 5 over here of section 3, too broad for first degree.
Move it into second degree.
First.
Well, it's in second degree automatically. It's something else.
Yeah, it would be.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, that...
If we take it out and make the commentary show that we're not intending not to make it a crime, but rather than merely intending to shift it, then it would be covered by Section 2 automatically.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And there's another point, too. It wouldn't preclude a district attorney from filing an information charging him with first degree on the theory that it was a public record, and if it failed to measure up to the level of being a public record, as was shown in the Brantley case,
it's
a lesser included a second degree. That might be...
Mr. Chairman, I move that we delete subsection 5 and the commentary appropriately show that we intend to have actions which would be covered by section 5 covered as a part of second degree forgery in section 2.
The motion is that subsection 5 of section 3 be deleted and that the commentary show that it is not our intention to say that it does not constitute a crime, but rather that those acts would come under Section 2. Is there any further discussion? All in favor will say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I think before we go on to Section 4, it might be appropriate for a minute to talk about forged prescriptions. Because I think we have a policy decision to make with regard to forged prescriptions. We discussed it at great length in the subcommittee, and I volunteered to write to the Oregon Medical Society and take it up with their counsel. And I'm frank to admit that I never did do it. People fired me. But some of the
best imitation we've had all day.
Some of the codes
forge your certificate of election.
Make forged prescriptions first degree forgery. And as I read this, it wouldn't be under our.
It wouldn't come under subdivisions.
No.
No. Now, with respect to the discussion, Mr. Chairman, we had in the subcommittee on October 18th, discussion on prescriptions, and I think Senator Burns indicated it is an important area, and perhaps we ought to, for the benefit of the members, read through the minutes here on that discussion. So,
why don't you read them aloud?
Chairman Burns asked if a forged prescription was covered in Section 3 and noted that New York included a provision prohibiting forged prescriptions under forgery in the second degree. Mr. Pallette expressed the view that if the subcommittee wished to include prescriptions in the forgery draft, a separate provision would have to be added. Justice Sloan commented that the majority of forged prescriptions would involve narcotics, and the subject might more appropriately be included under the Narcotics Act. Mr. Pallette advised that ORS 474-170, sub 1B, obtaining drugs unlawfully, now covered that situation. Mr. Chandler remarked that if Section 2 were amended to state with intent to injure, defraud, or deceive, prescriptions would then be covered by Section 2. Mr. Pallette replied that he believed the New York provision in this respect was too broad and pointed out that the mens rea element in the proposed forgery draft was the same as presently contained in the Oregon law, to injure or defraud. He said he would oppose the insertion of deceive in Section 2 because the draft then included acts amply covered elsewhere in the code. Mr. Spaulding was of the opinion that all dangerous drugs should be covered, whether or not they were narcotics, and urged that the integrity of prescriptions be protected. Mr. Pallette advised that he could find nothing in the health code which covered a forged prescription for anything other than a narcotic or a dangerous drug. He called attention to a section in the Narcotics Act, ORS 474-100, sub 3, relating to dangerous drugs, which stated, "No person shall willfully make any false statement in any prescription, order, report, or record required by this section, or by fraud, deceit, misrepresentation, or subterfuge, obtain or attempt to obtain any drug, or the administration of any drug included under subsection 1 of this section." Chairman Burns asked if inclusion of a similar provision in Section 2 would cause conflict. Mr. Spaulding observed that such a provision didn't belong in the forgery draft because it did not embody a concept to injure or defraud, probably should be contained in another part of ORS. Mr. Chandler suggested that the commission's report to the legislature indicate that there was a loophole in the statutes in this area, but the commission had not included it in its code revision because the members felt the provision did not properly belong in the criminal code. Chairman Burns expressed the view that the committee should agree on a solution to make a specific recommendation to the legislature. He indicated he would write the Oregon Medical Association an attempt to obtain specific facts on the existence and scope of the problem and forge prescriptions, and the committee agreed to defer further action until more information was available to them. They were also in agreement that the question was not related to the chapter on crimes against property. And that's pretty much the extent of the subcommittee discussion on that question.
Dr. Graham, do you have any?
Well, I don't understand all of the law here. This is covered in some other section of law, is it not?
It is now.
For just narcotics.
Yes.
Narcotics.
The question was whether dangerous drugs should be included.
Actually, whether all of
all
them
drugs,
should be
all prescriptions.
Yes, yeah. All prescriptions.
Prescriptions just don't fall under this situation of injury or fraud, do they? It's very dangerous that you wouldn't know that you intend to injure the fraud unless you say you're going to intend to injure yourself.
It would under deceive.
It's a possibility that the intent to injure would be present.
Yeah, but the possibility
is. Is there anything that you ought to leave in the narcotics section, or if you want to expand it to include penicillin or something, to put it in the medical code?
And there's regulations to control, too, of some form. I don't know besides your cases, but under the pharmacies and pharmacies, they have regulations to control their acts. It's not a matter of just opening it up so everybody can go after it.
The pharmaceutical regulations apply to the regulating the pharmacy, and the sanction is applied toward the seller, and we're trying to apply some sort of a sanction against the procurer. I can use that word broadly. But in every one of these codes that we've looked at, New York, Michigan, Connecticut, Ohio, Illinois, the trend seems to be toward embracing forged prescriptions within the forgery.
I can see that something might be developing here where a supplier of some types of pop pills for the kids forges a prescription to obtain a narcotic or some other dangerous drug and then utilizes that to obtain money by doing it in a circumscribed manner.
I take that back, Malapenal Force.
Seems to me that it would be advantageous to include it here.
I think so.
The forged prescription now for a dangerous drug or a narcotic is covered under the 475-100. But the discussion in the subcommittee was aimed at other types of prescriptions, and we just didn't feel that, well, we didn't know whether there was enough of a problem with respect to prescriptions for non-dangerous drugs and not narcotics to warrant inclusion in the forgery concept.
Well, how about some of the new drugs where they don't really know what the effect is going to be? What was this?
Yeah, and the prosecutor might have a hell of a time proving whether it's dangerous or not.
Well, but is that a function of the forgery section?
I wouldn't seem to mean
it. Well, we're talking about every other type of forgery, altering, changing. Why leave that out?
Talking about the altering of written instruments.
Yeah, you've got to go back to your section 2, which gets your intent into it.
Yeah.
These writings we're talking about here, it could violate section 2 and the writing is one of these, then it's section 2 first has to be violated, where you get in your intent to defraud or injure.
That's right.
That's right. And so that's why they specifically include this, to get around the language of section 2, by categorizing this type of instrument.
Well, is there an evil? Is there an evil there in guys walking around forging prescriptions for chloramycin or some of the new wonder drugs? I don't know.
There's certainly a good reason for keeping people from getting those drugs without the prescription from a person authorized to issue it because of the possibility of danger.
That's right.
But isn't that what we have, the various federal and state health authorities for, and the doctors and the pharmacy and all these people?
Well, I don't think that answers the question.
We have them for requiring or categorizing what has to be by prescription, but we don't have anything to protect the prescription itself.
How about getting him on Section 4, criminal possession of a forged instrument in the second degree?
Well, is it to injure or defraud, this prescription thing? Supposing that here's a drug of some sort that isn't particularly dangerous, but there's a forged instrument, has it been done with intent to injure or defraud? You'd have to use deceived in some way.
Well, when you get to Section 4, Tony, what I'm getting at, all you have to do is possess the altered instrument with knowing it to be forged and with intent to utter same. You don't, the intent there doesn't seem to be to defraud or injure. It's the mere possession of an altered forged instrument, which is defined here in somewhere. A forged instrument means a written instrument which has been falsely made, completed, or altered. And then you come to Section 4. A person commits the crime of criminal possession of a forged instrument in the second degree if knowing it to be forged, that is, knowing it to be falsely made, completed, or altered, and with intent to utter.
I think you could get him for possession.
Yeah.
Well, that's the Burke's
but
point.
It would have to be something capable of injuring or defrauding, though, when it was uttered, or it wouldn't come within his criminal possession of a forged instrument.
Why? He would have to have that.
Wouldn't have to.
It doesn't carry through, I don't think.
No.
Forged instrument simply means, according to our general definition back in Section 1 of this field here, forged instrument means a written instrument which has been falsely made, completed, or altered. That's all. Falsely made, completed, or altered. Then if you have one of the such an instrument, and you know it to have been falsely made, completed, or altered, and you intend to utter it, and to utter simply means to issue, deliver, publish, circulate, disseminate, transfer, or tender, you're guilty of this Section 4.
To go back further, the definition of written instrument, I think, already covers the question of prescription. The right to buy it, so
they
have about it.
Here in Section 4, we're covering prescriptions.
Did we adopt Dave Frost's suggestion with definition of written instrument?
No.
All
right, but if we haven't, I think that Bud's probably right on this.
Well, even without adopting that, I think we've got written instrument constituting a symbol or evidence of value or right. Do you have a right to buy a prescription drug without a prescription? Or is it a privilege to buy?
It's probably a privilege. I think it would be covered.
So I think probably in that definition and in Bud's reasoning from that, that it's already there.
I think he's right. Maybe we don't have a problem.
Well, I'm reluctant to say that we're statute here that makes it a crime to forge a prescription of penicillin. We don't know that that's an evil that ought to receive our attention. I don't know that it's evil. There are so many. It happens so frequently and with untoward results to some third party or to the person himself.
Oh, it could very well.
There's a potential there, though. But
there's any kind of. It lends itself to any kinds of problems. black marketing, prescriptive medicine. Anyone with a number of evils. But as everybody knows, the reason that this specific crime is commencing to appear in the first degree forgery revised code is simply because of the greater incidence of the use of drugs. But
we're not, as I understand, we're not talking about drugs, that is,
we're
narcotic.
We're talking about prescription.
If it's for aspirin.
Penicillin. You need a prescription.
I think somebody had the wisdom to say that a pharmacist could not sell. We're looking at the opposite point of view these things with the community without jeopardy. We're looking at it from a different point of view, point of the buyer. But they had wisdom to know that these were dangerous, therefore you should not sell it without some authority to have control. Mentioned Minnesota, whether it's evil or not, evil in itself is not the question. It's dangerous without proper knowledge. And Minnesota is dangerous without proper knowledge.
I agree.
Now, the question is whether they should be in jeopardy for attempting to obtain these things, even though they may have the self-knowledge that it may be harmless. That's philosophical.
Mr. Chairman, it is. I think probably that Berkeley has cured the problem for us, because it probably would come within Section 4 on possession. But if the medical profession has a reason for providing that only licensed or the doctors prescribe drugs, and it seems to me that for some layman, for whatever reason, to forge prescription constitutes a possible danger to the public good, and we have a policy decision to make to see whether or not such an act of this nature is sufficiently against the public good to be designated a crime. And I think the point that Bruce made in the subcommittee with regard to the fact that there are so many holes in the narcotic drug section now, with the rising number of new types of drugs, illustrates that even within that narrow area, or broad area, there are things that aren't covered.
Yeah, but there's a flexibility already there, John, because you've got the State Board of Pharmacy that has to determine whether or not a drug is a dangerous drug. Aspirin, I think Doug would probably agree, misused as a dangerous drug as far as it being injurious to the person. So we aren't going to cover all the problems in the world by just talking about a prescription. I think we ought to leave the flexibility where it now is for determining whether or not it's really dangerous enough to require sanctions. And I think it's in there right now. I think we're talking about is accepting it, not including it.
It seems to me that what Berkeley says is it would be included. And I think it probably is inclusive. The second point I have is that this could be a second party arrangement. An unlicensed physician, a person who purports himself to be a physician, or does not even purport himself, but just going to cure his family, friends, and neighborhood, would have no jeopardy whatever forging new prescriptions. Supposedly, but I think Berkeley does. If it does cover this, Senator Lentz.
I think it does cover it, but I think the commentary should show that it is the intention of this committee. Section 4 is possession, and it does constitute second degree. That's the intention of this committee, that prescriptions are included.
Under a written instrument?
Yes. Supposing that there isn't any alteration, that I write out a prescription. Of course, I'm covered by another code. But this wouldn't apply to that.
But if you write a fictitious document,
yes, if I sign some name, then I'd be in trouble. But if I sign my own name.
If you walk in with a little pad of those deals that says RX and it says power, they write it 4 bottles of penicillin, signed Dr. Aturi, that isn't a forged instrument.
No.
Medicine,
yeah. That's why I say the other codes will govern that.
It would come within forgery, though, because it's falsely making.
Why? It's a prescription written by Dr. Aturi for penicillin. Why is that falsely made?
All right, look at the definition of falsely make on sub 4 on section 1.
Authentic is the key word, is what you're saying?
Yeah, and it is authentic creation of the ostensible maker. Sure. I'm the ostensible maker.
Dr. Aturi's prescription for penicillin, that's as authentic as you can get.
Used for the purpose of reciting, embodying, conveying, or recording information.
Which purports to be
Well, let me see if I understand this. It would be a crime under second degree forgery to utter a forged prescription.
I think so.
Yes.
Is there the intent to injure and defraud?
Well, when you come to the definition of written instruments, you have it.
Well, you know,
that is,
but you get into the situation like they with a forged check, you've got to have the intent to defraud somebody. If you go in and cash a check in at a drugstore, a forged check, and you're defrauding the druggist out of his $25. But if you go in and with a forged prescription and get $20 worth of drugs, you pay him the $20 for it. So what has he or any person been defrauded out of to make it a crime?
Well,
and then you turn around and I don't think under section 4, possession of any type of a forged instrument has got to be something that would be capable of being passed and injured and defrauded somebody. Otherwise, possession of it isn't going to be a crime. We've had this problem on checks. A check is capable of being passed.
Well, it's under the definitions. It's included within written instrument. And under the definition of forged instrument, it means a written instrument which has been falsely made, completed, or altered. So I think it would be included.
Maybe we're splitting hairs, because the example that, and I'm responsible for raising it, but I think it's something we should discuss. The example of Dr. Uturi would be covered by obtaining money by or property by false pretenses or attempting to. That would be a criminal proscription there.
It wouldn't be forgery, but
There would be a sanction attached.
Well, that's still with intent to defraud.
Yeah.
Our possession.
Sunderland.
I think what we're really mixing up in here is how severely we want to punish these people. If we don't want the mere, if you have the mere possession of an altered prescription, for instance, or a falsely made one, the question is, we're talking about criminal possession of a forged instrument in the second degree here. Now, that's not a very serious thing. Do we think it's serious enough we ought to go more? I still think Section 4 covers it if you have it in your possession and you intend to utter. We don't get into intent to defraud or injure in this one at all.
No,
it isn't necessary, because we're talking about a forged instrument, and all it says there is that is a written instrument which has been falsely made, completed, or altered. There's no intent necessary at all in Section 4 except this last, the intent to utter something.
Well, it's not even forged unless it's been made with intent to defraud.
That's not so.
Somebody.
You read forged instrument back here in the first section, where it's defined. Forged instrument means a written instrument which has been falsely made, completed, or altered.
Well, I'm satisfied to move on.
Possession in itself doesn't violate Section 2, does it?
No, Section 4, Bruce, is violated if you have the forged instrument, you know it to be forged, and then you, and your intent, the only intent you have to, that's requisite, is the intent to utter it.
Mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't be a crime if you had it.
Pardon?
No, it wouldn't be a crime if you had it.
But you still would have had possession of it somewhere along the line.
You're going to make a crime possessing something that is no crime to
utter it.
To utter or do anything with.
Well, just a second. We'll go back to section 2, if I get to it.
Right.
Page and four. That is a person who commits the crime. There, of course, you have to have the intent to injure and
defraud. Yeah. So it's something that wouldn't be capable of, wouldn't constitute forging. Or a second degree forgery or a first degree.
No, I agree with you. It doesn't constitute forgery because of the different intent necessary.
Mr. Chairman, a minor point. Minor point, section 3, page 8, subsection 5. Written instrument officially issued or created by a public office, public servant, or government agency.
Bob, we've already deleted that before
That's
you
arrived. That's out? Fine.
All right, do you want to discuss section 4 then, or have we adequately covered that?
I hate to ask one more question on section 3. I think this has been covered in the subcommittee minutes, but on sub 4, a public record, is there presently a statutory definition of public record? the present Oregon statute.
Not a definition of it. It's included in the 43 statute, but they don't define that term.
Did the subcommittee have any?
Yeah, it's defined in ORS 192.005, sub 5.
Oh, well, my mistake.
And presumably then, the.
Is that set out here?
The definition would carry over.
Correct. We explicitly said that in the minutes, and it's 192.005, sub 5. Public record means a document, book, paper, or other material made.
Written
Well, are there any questions with regard to section 4?
Yeah. John, I'm still concerned about this definition of written instrument back, well, first page behind the folder. Because here again, you've got this press release situation. We're talking about a written instrument used for the purpose of reciting, embodying, or conveying or recording information. We aren't talking about defraud or injure anymore. This is about simply possessing it, apparently. The forged one is just one that's falsely made. Forged instruments, a written instrument, is falsely made, completed, or altered. I still wonder if we aren't talking about basically a value crime rather than a...
Rather than a... I see your point, David.
Straight deception crime.
I'm not committing any crime, but by possessing...
Can you address yourself to that, Tom?
I am.
I'm sorry, I couldn't...
David is worried about the language in the definition of written instrument, which talks about reciting, embodying, conveying, or recording information. Now, this is separate apart from the value aspect of...
That's in New York.
And New York is a little bit... You have a forged press release in your pocket, and you're guilty of... You're guilty of...
No,
criminal possession of forged instrument.
If you intend to utter
it. If you intend to utter it, you know it's forged.
In other words, I make up an instrument that looks like it's a press release from Senator Anthony Aturi, which he has never authorized. He didn't have anything to do with it. I make it. I'm carrying it around intending to hand it to the newspaper boys down in the... And Dave's point is that this doesn't gain me anything of value. It's not taking someone else's property or anything. And yet, I could be prosecuted for that under this language because it's that broad. Now, I think that's what you're saying.
That's right.
We're getting ourselves into an area where I assume probably the instances are endless. When you're just talking about embodying information or recording information or conveying information, and the rest of that language and the definition of written instrument, I think, gets at what we're talking about, and that's value, right, privilege, or identification is capable of being used.
Well, now, maybe I could, maybe we could talk about what we did, no, I'm sorry, I thought we made a change from our first draft, but we didn't. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, now, with respect to that definition of written instrument, which I think is what the problem seems to be, now, the New York commentary on that indicates that they were attempting to define instruments which may be the subject of forgery in the broadest possible terms, so they purposely used this kind of language. Now, they go on to point out that this conforms to the common law principle that forgery can be committed with respect to any writing which may be the means of defrauding another. Then it says, apparently inadvertently, the former penal law's forgery article considerably restricted the subjects of forgery, since on the one hand, it did not define them in general fashion, and on the other created numerous specific crimes applicable to certain designated instruments. Its crime of forgery was held to be narrower than the common law offense in this respect, and to embrace only those instruments explicitly specified in the substantive provisions. The revised provision restores the breadth of the common law crime by encompassing every document or other item susceptible of deceitful use in a forgery sense, which is capable of being used to the advantage or disadvantage of some person. So, And in following New York, we were trying to do the same thing, and that is to make it a broad definition. But perhaps we've made it too broad. But as they point out, this does restore the common law approach to this.
I think Section 4 is broad enough to catch something like a certain senator taking a lady senator's pads and writing a note to the president of the Senate on it.
I think it is. But senators are not subject to criminal sanctions, except in the city of Salem.
I'd like to know what Professor Platt thinks about this.
I stepped out of room for a moment. Are we on Section 4?
Yeah.
I have an observation that I don't think is responsive directly to what we're talking about, but I think it's a very important policy issue. If I'm not responsive to your question, please excuse me. But Section 4 raises an interesting point that the Commission will look at with respect to inchoate crimes, the article on inchoate crimes. Possession is incomplete criminal conduct. It's an inchoate crime. The Model Penal Code in Section 5.06 of the article on inchoate crimes defines the crime of possessing instruments of crime. And clearly that definition would encompass what you are specifically attempting to do here, that is make possession of this particular kind of an instrument a crime. In one other instance that I know of, the Commission has already approved this kind of an offense with respect to the possession of burglar's tools. Yes. I raised in the inchoate crime draft, which Donna got that, didn't you?
I haven't read it. It's being typed.
The draft of this article is not complete and should reach the Commission within a relatively short time. And I raised the issue there that the inchoate crimes article really, I think, is the better place for all possession-type crimes to be, although I realize that you've made a decision with respect to burglar's tools. I don't know what the solution is. I don't know what your reaction to this would be, but I think that rather than try to proliferate possession-type crimes, it's better to concentrate them within the article which really deals with the basic concept of criminality, that is, the incompleteness or the inchoateness of this kind of crime.
Well, George, in your draft on inchoate crimes, did you adopt the Model Penal Code language?
Yes.
Well, no,
I withdraw that because I'm not even sure that I included it in the rough draft. I can't remember now, that's what I wanted to see the draft for. I do recall raising the issue suggesting that maybe the section ought to be added in inchoate crimes, or depending on what the Commission wants to do with this particular kind of offense. Obviously, if you would rather define possession with respect to each particular kind of crime, then it ought not to be in the section of inchoate crime necessarily.
But we run into a problem, though. Take the prescription example, and say here in inchoate crimes,